Welcome to David Clark's We Are Superman podcast, episode number 111. I am your host, Bill Stahl, and I'm very excited to talk today with someone I have known since 2005, entrepreneur and best-selling author Frank Fiume. Frank and I talk about his quest for purpose, which didn't hit him until after he'd already begun his career in medical sales. Frank, a baseball and more specifically a New York Yankees fanatic, who of course is some of my favorite people, Frank saw an opportunity to transform men's softball on Long Island, New York from a ragtag amalgamation of disorganized leagues. He conquered all of his competition to create the largest sports organization on Long Island by simply giving players what they wanted, excellent service and product. Frank then spun that into I-9 Sports, which is the largest private youth sports organization in the country, with 170 franchises in 30 states, with 2 million players participating in recreational flag football, soccer, baseball, volleyball, lacrosse, basketball, and cheerleading. I bought an I-9 Sports franchise when Frank was just starting to sell franchises, and I owned it for 14 years until a year ago. During that time, I always enjoyed a closer relationship with Frank and all of the management team there, very different than owning a mega-sized franchise. But Frank had his share of his ups and downs. As he says, progress isn't a straight line. It's a zigzag, just as it is if you're trying to lose weight, achieve sobriety, or even keep your New Year's resolutions. Frank hit one of his hardest ones when he got introduced to diet pills as an easy means to counter his workaholic lifestyle. At some point, Frank became a devotee of motivational superstar Tony Robbins, who helped him see that his life needed a new purpose. So Frank sold I-9 Sports in 2017 and wrote a book called Running With My Head Down, an entrepreneur's story of passion, perseverance, and purpose. He provides readers in a style reminiscent of David Clark, with a very open, honest, and revealing telling of his successes and struggles to achieve purpose. I highly, highly recommend you pick it up on Amazon or other booksellers. Frank has recently founded Game 3 Capital, which gives guidance to business owners to franchise their idea, similar to what Frank did in the mid-2000s with I-9 Sports. So I hope you'll enjoy this very special episode. I'd also like to remind you about the homework I gave you, that if David inspired you, changed you, or even saved your life, that I would love for you to share your story with the world in what I am calling David's fourth book that I'm putting together so everyone can benefit from his love and wisdom. I'd like to get most of these stories here in January. I'm not picky about their length, but I'm sure they will inspire others. So my contact information is in the show notes, silly_billy@msn.com. I'm also on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram as @Stahlor. That's @STAHLOR. And I can also do a phone interview with you if you prefer. As it looks more like races will happen in 2021, do you have goals that were mothballed in 2020? Now is the time to get after them. Consider joining the We Are Superman Leadville 10 Warriors. It is a running group based on Gandhi's 10 principles for changing the world. David's girlfriend Courtney and I will provide you coaching to achieve audacious goals like completing races from 5Ks to marathons, to eat better, feel better, fight for your sobriety, and have a positive outlook on life. You will receive training plans. We have every other week group Zoom calls and a very supportive Facebook community. So please shoot me a message for more info. And I'd also like to encourage you to go to the Workshed podcast website or Instagram account. David was going to visit Ian Lawton in County Meath, Ireland, which is David's ancestral home, but unfortunately that never got to happen. I've gotten to know Ian, and he is nothing short of amazing. We are going to do a simulcast podcast here, episode here in the near future, but right now, Ian is planning to run 10 marathons in 10 days, starting on January 23rd, on the 10th anniversary of when he and his wife lost their one-day-old son, Hank. Similar in spirit to David's epic 10 on his 10th year of sobriety. So Ian is raising funds for bereaved dads, so I wish him the best of luck. Oh, and did I mention that Ireland is currently in a level 5 lockdown, so Ian is going to have to run all of these marathons on a 400-meter track. Wow. So I'm going to include some links in the show notes, and if you would like to donate to support Ian and his very worthy cause, that would be great. Okay, now here's Frank Fiume from Tampa, Florida, and me. Hi, Frank. How you doing?
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Doing great. We got Frank here from Tampa, Florida. He is dressed to the nines as far as I'm concerned. He's got his Yankees jersey on there. We won't mention what player he's wearing because we're not too proud of him these days. But
That's true. We'll leave that out.
Yep.
Pay attention to the front.
Yeah, if you're a Yankee fan, it's the Kraken, but you know that goes right over your head if you don't know who that is. So, it's great to see you. It's been a while. You know, I was thinking earlier today, I've actually known you, or we've known each other since 2005.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. Time goes by, sure, goes by quick.
Right. So I'd come down to Tampa for Discovery Day with I-9 Sports, and I-9 Sports was just great right off the bat because I could sit there and talk to the owner about baseball. It was just
awesome.
That's
true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it was such a fun ride. And I'm so grateful that you came along so early on and I was able to be able to have that involvement, that one-on-one involvement with the franchise owners and, to see people grow from the very beginning. Made it all the more special. Believing in the vision and for being part of it, it means the world to me.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, the concept was a natural for me, but what sold it were the people there because, you know, I'd looked into various other franchise opportunities at the time, and they just seemed like, you know, you're just another number out there. You know, it's like owning McDonald's franchise number 20,862 was not that interesting to me, but I could sit there and talk with the owner. And it wasn't just talking about the business aspect, which of course we did, but the fact that we could talk about everything from, you know, what are the merits of the mercy rule in a kids flag football game to, you know, talking about the Yankees or whatever other sports topics we wanted to. And, you know, it was nice also, it was a small franchise at the time, which still is, but, you know, it was, I was there, I think it was the second year you were franchising, correct?
Yeah. In fact, 2004 was our first spring of 2004 was the first season that our first franchisees. That's right. You came on board spring 2005, if I recall, was your first season.
Or was it 2006? I can't remember, but I started like January. January 2006. 2006, right? Yep.
Yep. It was 2006.
Yeah.
That's right. Because I remember we switched out the jerseys and that's another story, but yes.
Right.
Just spring 2006.
Yeah. Just when you guys were dumping the NFL flag.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep, for sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
So it was great. So it was great to meet you then and great to get involved with I-9 Sports. And we'll talk a lot more about I-9 Sports in a bit, but I'm so happy to have you on here so we can share your story about how you got started with it all. You started out growing up in Queens, New York, and happy childhood, but a lot of things happen along the way, right?
Absolutely. You know, all of us have adversity in our lives and it happens at different stages of our lives. For me, it was, you know, a happy childhood. My parents were, childhood sweethearts, got married really young. My dad got out of the Navy and they had known each other since they were like 14 years old. My dad got out of the Navy. My parents got married and a year later I was born. So they were, you know, 22-year-old kids. They, loved each other. But as relationships go, relationship changed. And needless to say, when I was about 7 years old is when my parents got divorced and everything truly from where I stood as a child, everything kind of crumbled from there because, I was ignorance is bliss, right? When you're a kid.
Right.
And, so it was obviously very difficult. Probably the most challenging part was that, after my parents divorced, we had moved out to Long Island and my dad was a very successful cardiac perfusionist. He was the guy that ran the heart lung machine during open heart surgery. Hmm. And he did this in the city at Lenox Hill Hospital. And he was a pioneer in the industry. My mom, of course, like, you know, many ladies, especially back in the early 70s, was the stay at home mom and, you know, her role and was to be that stay at home mom, which was not all that easy at all, especially trying to, you know, handle me and my sister. But, you know, the difficult part was after my parents got divorced, there was a tale of two lives, so to speak, on how we lived economically. You know, I lived with my mom. We still lived in Long Island for a period of time. And then things got a little rough and we moved to an apartment in Queens. And we bounced around kind of from apartment to apartment in Queens. And my dad had lived He was very successful in his right and lived in a beautiful home in Long Island, you know, on the marina, waterfront with the boat in the background and in the backdrop and everything. And he had remarried, and he always did the right thing by my mom to, you know, with alimony and child support. But it was kind of weird for me and my sister, because we would go to my dad's every other weekend and kind of living this fantasy world, so to speak.
Right.
And then really by Sunday night being driven back home into Queens.
Yeah.
Living in an apartment, which in some cases was a basement apartment. Another time it was a slum-like apartment in College Point, Queens. But I'll tell you what, there was so much benefit to that. It made me value what's so important in life.
Right.
It turns out it had nothing to do with money, you know, because at the end of the day, a house is only four walls and a ceiling. And it's really a home is what you make it. So, but there was a lot of adversity to go through as a kid by just experiencing as a child, because everything is happy. And then one minute your life is totally changed.
Oh yeah.
You're experiencing these tale of, like I say, two economic scenarios.
Right. Yeah. Rough deal. And then it kind of carried forward, because at that point as a kid, you're kind of wondering what world you belong in. And you really kind of struggled, I would guess, with your identity at that point. Right.
Totally. Yeah. You know, in school too, because now keep in mind, this is the 70s, and
right.
In the mid 70s, divorce wasn't in the forefront. It wasn't 50% of all marriages ended in divorce in the mid 70s. And I was the first kid in my class this was in second grade. I was the first kid in my class with divorced parents.
No kidding.
I was I was kind of looked at as like the outsider in my class to my friends in the neighborhood. You know, how is it with your parents divorced? And I had all these questions, and my parents really tried to shield me by making everything kind of nice. But I felt, by feeling different, I did feel out of place.
Right.
There was definitely a feeling of inadequacy, and for no reason I could really put my finger on it. It was just different.
You were very different. Right.
And I didn't even know what that meant. I just knew that I didn't have the happy home. But I didn't have any to compare it to, right? Because I didn't have a role model of what that looks like by having, because it's more than just parents not living together. It's two completely separate lives is really what it was.
Yeah, well, other kids weren't getting carted off somewhere else for the weekend like you were.
Yeah, and the truth is, coming home after being carted off,
right?
Coming home and was a little bit of an adjustment is really what it was. But interesting was that even though going to my dad's was this beautiful home, and my sister and I had bedrooms there, it didn't feel like our home.
Sure.
I felt like this little boundary. My father was married at the time, and you know, my stepmother did the best she could. Her model of the world was to be a disciplinarian. And you know what? At the end of the day, Bill, she was a kid, right?
I mean, right.
we're talking about people that were in their 20s. We're not talking about people that were 40, 50 years old and can understand this. We're talking about kids in their 20s that are trying to figure out their own lives. And my stepmother, as well as she tried to be, she went the route of trying to be a disciplinarian first, instead of trying to create a relationship and be friends with these kids before being the, you know.
But that's the way it was done back then, right?
Well, it was for her and her family.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, I'm sure my dad regrets allowing that to happen, because it ended up making her the wicked stepmother unnecessarily by him not stepping up. And again, people do the best they can. And I have no regrets of, you know, going through that experience. Not that I would want to experience that again. And I've learned a lot from it, but it just goes to show you that, you know, people do the best with the resources that they have.
Oh yeah.
These kids were in their 20s, and look, I benefited from it because I learned from it. My kids reap the benefits of it. And hopefully I've touched other people's lives differently because of that experience.
Absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. And then, so you kind of followed in your dad's footsteps in a little way. I mean, you kind of, you know, you grew up, you went through college, St. John's, was it?
Yes.
Yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then kind of, he being in the medical field, it kind of led you into the medical field as well, right?
Ooh, well, that was a big fight, actually.
Yeah.
So my dad is he's a very low risk guy. He was a guy who worked at the same job for 30 years. His goal was, to retire, get the pension, retire to Florida and move on from there. And I had this entrepreneurial spirit. I was also a huge sports fan.
Right.
I was the kid that tore apart my backyard and made it into a wiffle ball field. I was creating leagues. I was running Stratomatic leagues as a 10-year-old for those diehard baseball fans from way back. You know what Stratomatic is?
I think Strato's still around, isn't it?
Strato is still around, yeah, but right. it's a cult,
yes,
following Stratomatic, right? So I'm this kid at 10 years old creating these leagues, Stratomatic leagues, and starting these wiffle ball leagues. And, my dad would watch a game with me. We'd go to a game once in a while, but he didn't have the love of sport like I did. So when I got to St. John's, I knew that I wanted to go somewhere. I knew I was going into business, but I stumbled on the major of athletic administration. And this is before the days of sports management being a major, right?
Sure.
So this is the 80s. And at St. John's, they had athletic administration as a major, and they touted that they teach you all about the administration of sports, and they have internships with the Yankees, Mets, Jets, Giants, Islanders.
Oh God, Nirvana. Rangers.
Oh my gosh. And Bill, I am so excited because my thing growing up was always like, what am I going to do with my life? Like, what am I supposed to do? And I really stressed over it. And when I learned about this, I got so excited. I came home. This is when I was living with my dad, because I moved in with him my last 2 years of college, or sophomore year. And I said, Dad, I'm so excited. I know what I want to do. I'm going to switch majors. I'm going to athletic administration. And he's like, well, what are you going to do? And I told him about these internships. And he's like, let me look into it and get back to you. The next day, he calls me up. And he's like, you don't want to do that. And I said, why not? He goes, well, my friend is a former kicker of the New York Jets. His name was Jim Messimer. I don't know if you remember the name.
No, it doesn't ring a bell. Well, he must have sucked.
No, I don't
remember. He was on the Jets. Yeah, of course he sucked. Yeah. He was,
of course he did. And it must have been the mid-70s too, so they definitely sucked. Or 2020, either year. It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't, right?
But anyway, so Jim told my dad, don't let your son major in sports, because the only people that ever get jobs in sports are the former pro athletes. So my dad's telling me this. And my dad says to me, you better not do it, because otherwise you'll be nothing more than a $18,000 a year gym teacher in an elementary school somewhere.
Ooh.
And I was taken back by it. And see, I felt like I knew I had information that he didn't have. But you know what, Bill? I listened to him. Look, I take full responsibility and I'm accountable for my own decisions. I ended up taking the safer route, finishing my business degree, which nothing wrong with that, yeah. Right? And I ended up going to medical sales because he shared with me, he goes, look, guy's making six figures, calling on doctors. So lo and behold, I got a job working in medical sales, and I was calling on open heart surgeons, selling like blood filters and tubing and then the equipment. And I freaking hated it. I hated it.
Yeah.
But on the weekends, I was playing softball with my college buddies in a recreational softball league in Long Island.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, you know something? If I start a softball league and I treat teams the way I treat the chief of open heart surgery at, say, NYU, I don't know, maybe this could be a business. I mean, truly, it was like that.
Did you really have that epiphany then? Or, I mean, just like,
I did. I'm okay. Like, maybe it'll be because we were paying a lot of money to play in these recreational bar leagues. I got stuck being the manager of the team. My college buddies, the old thing, the college buddies say, right, I'll pay you back. You go join the league. So that was me. I was the one that got stuck being the manager. And the more I'm looking into it, Bill, I'm going, oh my gosh, these guys are making money. They're getting fields. They're marketing to teams poorly. I could do that. And the schedules are never out on time. They're not giving the standings out. Things are always freaking wrong. You can't get a hold of anybody. I'm like, well, I can do that. I can do a better job.
Yeah.
So I started running a softball league on the side. And that's how I kind of my purpose started to form. And just to kind of tie this all together, it just goes to show you that even though back in college, I wanted to go the route of sports and I veered away from it, look, I can't, it came right back to me. So my point is that for those that are listening to this podcast, they're saying, ah, would have, could have, should have, you know what? You are where you're supposed to be. And the truth is that if you're supposed to end up somewhere, you will get there. You may take a different road. And thank goodness I was in medical sales despite hating it, because I learned how to work autonomously. I learned how to call on doctors and how to interact with them. I learned customer service. I learned how to manage a team. I learned how to sell. All of those benefits or all those skills I learned on somebody else's dime.
Right.
And maybe I would not have created a company like I9 Sports if I had just gone from athletic administration and working. Maybe I would have gotten as far as an internship with the Islanders, and that's where as far as it would have gotten. Who knows? I don't know where it would have ended up, but you end up where you end up. So I hope that people listening to this understand that there's always a way. And I very much believe in destiny.
Yeah, and I also think there's a lot to be said for adversity as part of your heritage, if you would. It's part of your fabric. Like I say, you may not have gone into the direction you did had it not been for what some people may have said was a negative experience. And I was blown away when I heard an interview about a year ago with Hillary Allen, who you probably don't know her. She's a world-class runner. She was doing a mountain race over in Norway, had a catastrophic fall up there. And I mean, literally had to be airlifted out of there. And I mean, she was like, she thought she was going to die, literally. And she recovered. I mean, she's a world-class runner and everything. But I was blown away when I heard her say, "I'm so glad this happened to me." Because, you know, you'll learn certain things about perseverance and overcoming adversity, whatever it is. But she learned a lot of important lessons. She said, "I would not have wanted to go through not having that as part of who I am."
Right. We don't enjoy it while we're going through it. But you're right. When we look back, we say it made us who we are. And the big benefit of that is that anytime you face another adversity, you can reflect back on prior adversity and going, you know what? Shit. Most people would not have survived that.
Right.
Or I didn't quit back then. I certainly can't quit now. See, all those things happen. You could only have that kind of conversation with you and internalize it when you've had that adversity in the past.
Yeah.
But you're right. No one. So that I think that's key. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, you can look at cancer survivors and how they appreciate life more after having gone through a scare like that or something. You know, absolutely makes sense. So you started up this softball league and it grew like wildfire, right?
Yeah, it grew quickly. You know, what helped me was I loved people telling me no. I loved hearing it'll never work. Yeah. And anybody who I mentioned about wanting to start this softball league as like a real business told me all the reasons why it wouldn't work. You're never going to get the fields. You're never going to get the teams. You're never going to get umpires. Who are you? Why is a team going to join your league? All those things. And I chipped away and I got, you know, I was getting terrible fields. My quality of the fields I was getting for softball fields was terrible in the beginning. But I was honest. I would tell teams, but here's what I did. I knew what my value proposition was. I knew what my strength was. I couldn't compete with the other leagues that were out there because they had the better fields, but I can out-service them and out-hustle them. And what I did was I answered the freaking phone for one right there. I mean, if, you know, we're talking pre-internet. So people had to go through the newspaper on Fridays and New York Newsday, and they would see all the leagues that were advertising. And only one league answered the phone on Friday mornings, my league, because either I answered the phone or my wife, Nadine, answered the phone.
Yeah.
And just if you could imagine, when you're looking to buy something, generally, the first time somebody picks up the phone, it's the first person you speak to that you usually do business with. You're not going to generally don't shop around for a service like that. When you find somebody, you're talking to them, you build rapport. And I knew what each competitors, what they offered. I knew the pros and cons because I was a customer.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I was a player. So I came at it from a different perspective. So the league did grow and I started running circles around the other leagues because I just started snatching up little fields, you know, a time slot here, a time slot there. And lo and behold, I grew exactly how I could have never predicted. I grew because, quite simply, I was getting the phone calls for teams to register for my league. And my competitor wasn't getting the call.
Right.
They weren't getting the registrations and they started throwing fields back little by little.
Awesome.
It's a simple formula. It was simple as that.
Yeah.
They didn't need the field. They threw the field back and I was there like that. And also I treated every one of the venue owners, you know, I'd go to the Parks and Rec or the school and try to get the field. I treated them like customers. I would go there and schmooze with them and share with them what we're doing with our league, why we're different, provide with them the insurance, not going to have any problems, not going to be any alcohol in the field.
Right.
All those things. I gave reassurance and I was coming across professionally. So the league did grow. It grew, in fact, almost 1,000 teams. We went from being a startup in 1995 to being the largest league, adult men's softball league in the state of New York, privately owned by 2001. And we ended up at some point like by 1,000 teams is where we ended up.
Wow.
So you just chip away. You know, it was never just given, hey, here's 20, 30 fields at a time. It was chipping away and just never giving up.
Right. And like you say, just treating people the way they would like to be treated. Simple.
It's that simple. It really is.
Yeah, that's awesome. Next steps. You decided to go into youth sports or, you know.
Yeah. So this is kind of crazy. So one of the things that I share with people is that when you want to learn something, you want to be successful in something you endeavor, you need to think of yourself as a student of the industry and just soak up everything you can learn, no matter what industry you're looking, whatever you're interested in. So I didn't have any experience in running youth sports leagues. You know, I'm this guy running adult men's softball leagues. And I learned about all these different types of sports associations. Like, for example, there was a private sports complex owners association. And it's a group of guys that own private sports complexes around the country. And they would get together. And I would go. I became a member, even though I didn't have a sports complex of my own.
Right.
But I was listening. I was listening to what their opportunities were. I was listening to the challenges. And Bill, it dawned on me that no matter where I went, no matter where these in the country, these guys were, they were having the same exact challenges. Registering teams and marketing. And well, for them, because they had a private sports complex, it was, you know, keeping the turnstile spinning, of course.
Yeah.
Their private sports complex. Is, you know, has a whole host of problems. But I also learned about the opportunities and what they were doing well. And I started learning about youth sports. And that it made me think, okay, maybe I'm missing something. At this point, I was not a parent yet. We didn't have our first child yet. And it was around this time, by doing the research, reading everything I could, it was in a publication that I read that the NFL was going to they were going to start promoting NFL flag football for kids as a way of promoting the game of football in the local communities.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? That's what we're doing next. I'm going to use the NFL's brand. The NFL wasn't providing training. They weren't providing the how-to. I had that from my softball league. What I didn't have was I didn't have the brand, or I didn't have the jerseys, I didn't have the equipment.
Yeah.
And they provided the rules. It was pretty much like a league out of a box. But what they didn't have was the how to do it. And I already had that. So my wife and I, at this point, we had already moved to Tampa. So we have our league still running in Long Island for adult men's softball. We're here in Tampa and we're going to start running youth flag football leagues. And everybody who we mentioned that we're going to start running kids football leagues are consistent with the same thing. That is, it'll never work. People don't play. I'm like, oh, here we go again.
You're right.
They're like, no. People will not play flag football because this is Florida. They play real football. They play tackle football.
Ooh yeah.
I don't know this at this point. I mean, right. I'm this Yankee from New York living here in Tampa, and I'm having people all tell me this, and maybe they were right. But you know what? Once again, I had to go with what I thought was the right thing to do, use my gut. And my intuition told me from going to these sports complex owner meetings and everything I read that this is going to freaking work. I got 100 kids next season. I got 600 kids. And now we're onto something, because now I realize we've got kids sports in Florida. We've got adult men's sports in New York. And I said to my wife, we got to figure out how to expand this thing. I'm not sure how to do it. I'm really uncomfortable about hiring people around the country who I don't know.
Right.
And I stumbled on franchising. And again, I became a student of franchising. So like anything, you've got to be a student and just absorb everything you can. and I started reading about franchising.
Nice. Now, I was just thinking, you only had men's softball on Long Island, you misogynistic bastard.
No, we did add co-ed. Co-ed never really took off for us for some reason. In fact, we didn't even do fast pitch softball. We were like adult men slow pitch. You know what? But Bill, it's funny you should say that. Think about what we did with I-9 Sports, not to jump ahead, but if you think about the market as a big pizza pie, most people think when they think even on kids sports, they go, oh, I'm going to start running like competitive travel leagues.
Yeah.
And you know what? That is like a sliver of the market. So I let people fight that fight in that little sliver of the pie. I'll take the bigger piece.
Right.
And the same thing with adult men's softball. Adult men's recreational softball was the perfect niche for us because people wanted to fight the good fight for like tournament teams. Tournament teams make up a sliver of the market. Like, why even bother with that?
Sure.
But it has the cachet. Like, I'm running this, you know, A level softball tournament. Well, you know what? Good luck. There's like 20 of them, 20 teams total. So enjoy that. I'll go after the other 1,000 teams that are looking for a well-run league. And co-ed, we did a little bit with corporate teams, but most of the co-ed leagues play weeknights after work. And I had all of my fields were Saturdays and Sundays.
So
it kind of limited our co-ed ability to grow.
All right. Makes sense. All right, so you decide to get started with I-9 Sports, or you know, you're working with. Obviously, you hit some road bumps along the way, right?
Ooh, yeah, totally. Well, again, trying to learn everything you can to be a student, even though no matter how much you read and learn. Right. The other thing I tell people is that when you're looking to do something, you have to. Success leaves clues, right? You want to find a mentor, somebody who's already done that. For me, I had found a couple of mentors when I was running adult men's softball league, softball leagues, guys that were so generous with information and so willing to show me the ropes that when I got to franchise, looking at franchising, I said, okay, well, I got to do the same thing and I have to find a mentor. I called around, I spoke to a lot of franchise type consultants, and I found this one franchise consultant that I really hit it off with. His name is Mark Siebert. He's the founder of the iFranchise Group out of Chicago.
Yeah. And sure.
Mark is a super nice guy, and he's been a dear friend of mine now for 20 years, and I still talk with him. And, you know, Mark kind of was, you know, obviously shared with me, here's how to franchise. And not just that, but he was so honest with me on how to make this company, which was unnamed yet, I-9 Sports, you know, how do we name it? And or how do we create this thing from nothing? And again, help it with Mark's help. I wanted to make sure I do it right, because as I would tell anybody who's listening to this, it's that if you're going to do something big and you want to dream big, my belief is either, you know, do it right or don't do it at all. Don't do it halfway, because it's so easy to quit something if you do it halfway. You jump in with both feet. And, you know, as they say, burn the boats and, you know, you're on the island and that's it.
Yeah.
You got to take the island and burn the boats.
Love it.
And that's what we did.
Yeah.
And that's how I-9 Sports was born. It was just like, that's it. I sold ABA, actually sold the adult men's softball league because I needed to raise capital to franchise. So I literally burned the boats.
Right.
Sidebar, I talked to my dad and told my dad, who, by the way, was against me starting the softball league.
Of course.
It would never work. I told him I was going to sell ABA softball league to start I-9. He said to me, how can you possibly kill the golden goose?
Right.
So it was just then that I knew that I was doing the right thing. No offense, but I knew that, you know, he thought differently and I had a much bigger vision and a much more entrepreneurial vision than him. And he was looking out for me. He wanted me to be safe. He didn't want me to be hurt. He didn't want me to fail.
Right.
But when he said you can sell the golden goose, I knew it was time to sell the golden goose. It was the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Reminds me of, not to compare your dad to Colonel Klink and Hogan's Heroes, but it was kind of the same thing. Like anything Colonel Klink chose, you knew was the wrong thing.
It's just that, you know what, he didn't see. So anybody who's, again, if you're listening to this and you have a vision, somebody that your friends or family that aren't agreeing, they're not agreeing because they don't see what you see. They don't see your vision. But also the other thing that I want people to remember, and I used to tell this to people coming in to buy an I-9 Sports franchise. I would say this, that our friends and family love us. They don't want to see us fail.
Right.
And when they tell us they don't think of something going to work, It's because they're visualizing themselves in that situation. And if they can't see themselves succeeding in it, that's when they say, I don't think this is a good idea.
Right.
Because they just don't want you to fail. They don't. They want to protect you. Yeah, so my dad wasn't looking for me to be hurt. That's really what it came down to.
Yeah, and that's the overriding thing. They are looking at your security, your safety, et cetera. And it reminds me a lot. David Clark had told me, you know, I knew this, but he kind of put it to words, made me realize, like, when you're running an ultra marathon, the people you do not want as part of your crew is your family. Because as soon as you say, oh, you know, I'm hurting, I'm tired, or, you know, I don't know if I can keep going, your family's going to say, yeah, good idea. Let's drop out.
That's it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the smart thing to do. You will not die if you drop out. But you need somebody who instead is going to say, F you, get out of that chair and get the hell back out there, because later on, you're going to regret this.
Exactly. You were built for this. You trained for this. You're going to finish this. That's right. What you need.
Yeah.
Right. That's what we all need. And that's having that mentor. That, and for me, those mentors were people who were not related to me, just like that, you know, the example you use. So it's when somebody can share in your vision that gives you hope. And that's really all I was looking for. Looking for my dad's reassurance, whether it was in college, looking for that major in sports management or starting the softball league.
Right.
I was just looking for somebody to give me hope that what I was doing, I had so much conviction that I was doing the right thing, but I'm human. I had self-doubt creeped in all the time, especially when I struggled. But I got far enough along. It was just like, I've come too far now. I can't quit now. It's just, I should have quit earlier. And because I didn't quit earlier, now I can't quit.
You're
and
committed.
I mean, you probably go through that in a marathon, right? Where you're running and you go, well, shit, I've gone this far. Now I really can't stop, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, we all know about the wall. I mean, it's whether it's real or not, but you get to 20, 21 miles and 5 or 6 miles more seems like a lot, you know, and you're like, shit, I can't move my legs anymore or whatever's going on. And then you have to shut that out and just say, it's 5 or 6 miles. God damn it. I can push through 5 or 6 more, you know?
Right. And it's the same, And that is the same thing with business, and where so many people go wrong when they're getting a business off the ground is they think they hit that wall where they think about how hard the path was from where they started to today.
Right.
Instead of going, I only have this much more to go. And I would see it time and time again as the franchisor and having entrepreneurs come to me and say, I want to buy a franchise. And they would start, they get into that grind, so to speak. We would sit around 18 to 24 months. People would hit the grind of their business where they go, oh my gosh, I've worked so hard. Like, I'm not seeing the fruits of my labor. And I'm going, no, you are right there. Like, I can see the finish line. You can't quit now. But they were looking back to go, look how long ago, it was 18, 24 months I've been at this. And I'm going, no, but you're not at the starting line. I could see the finish for you. And that's in any entrepreneurial situation that I see with people. And obviously it works in the case of running too. I think it's life, it's self-doubt, and it's thinking too much about the past instead of truly staying present and seeing where the finish line is.
Yeah. And when you look at the past in business terms, it's what they call sunk cost. Basically you've already put that in. It's there whether you move forward or not. So screw it. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. True.
Yeah, absolutely. So the I-9 sports concept is great. I mean, I was sold on it very quickly. It's all about, as I told people, the fun part of sports. You know, it's not about all the NFL scouts coming to watch your kid or the college recruiters coming out here. This is about playing sports for the reason why we always played sports from the time we were a little kid, even why I played sports as an adult, because it was fun. Right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And the adults are the ones that get in the way, right? The parents are we're the problem as the adults. It's the kids. We played sports because we wanted to have fun. We wanted to have a great time with our friends. We wanted to learn something, and we wanted to win. Don't get me wrong. We always wanted to win, but it wasn't win first. It was having fun with our friends first.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, we all know about little league parents. I don't want to pick on them in particular, but it's kind of the generic term for what the hell we see on the nightly news sometimes, right?
Yeah, well, it scared me, honestly, about getting into youth sports, because remember, now I'm coming from this adult men's softball league. I grew this thing out, and I'm going to get into kids sports. I'm thinking, what am I doing? And it was around this time that in the news, this is back in the late 90s, you might remember, it was in, I think, in Massachusetts, where this one hockey dad choked out another dad.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was like in the late 90s, if I recall. And it was like things like that, and you'd see all these problems on the field. And I remember thinking to myself, like, what am I getting myself into by getting involved in kids' sports? And my daughter was born in 98. So when our first season kicked off, it was actually the fall of 1998. And we'd bring her to the field, and she was just a little infant at the time. And then in 99, had my next season. And it was just like, what made us different, though, is the truth is that when moms would call to register their kids, I had this little bit of apprehension in the back of my head that they were a problem, right? Because of what we see in the news.
Right.
And I would tell the moms, look, this is what I-9 Sports is about. This is not about making your kid into the next, Joe Montana or Jerry Rice. Okay. This is about fun, safety, convenience. All the kids going to play. It's equal playing time. Like, in other words, I don't want to hear your nonsense. I don't want any BS. I don't want any problems with you people. Just bring your kid to the game and have fun.
Right.
But still, by me saying that on the other end of the phone, I was getting this sigh of relief, like, this is exactly what I've been looking for.
Right.
So the truth is that I-9 was kind of crafted almost out of mistake. It was a beautiful, just natural evolution of, I don't want any problems from you people. I just want your kid to have fun.
Right.
And that's what they ultimately wanted. And by doing that and focusing on the fun, safety, and convenience, obviously we struck a nerve, a beautiful nerve in the industry, and that made us launch rather quickly and spread nationwide.
Absolutely. So it's what, 15, 16 years later, and I-9 Sports has got, I may get these numbers a little bit wrong, 140, 150 franchises, probably a million kids playing.
About 170 franchisees that are running close to 1,000 locations now.
Wow.
In 30 states. Yeah. Yeah. They're doing really, really well. And I think why the company has done well is because they know their lane, right? They stay in their lane.
Right.
They know what they're good at. They're not getting involved in running these travel leagues and tournaments, and getting involved in the competitive side of things. They know we're about fun, safety, and convenience. We're about helping kids develop, and most importantly, age-appropriate programming, right? So
huge.
The way the league is going to operate for a 3-4-year-old is going to be totally different than how they're going to offer the program for the 12 to 14-year-old. And that's what the company, I think, has done really, really well.
No, without a doubt.
They know who they are. Yeah.
No, and the growth has been explosive, like you say, because parents really appreciate all that. They appreciate the age-appropriate programming, the convenience. They show up. It's once a week. For most of the sports, they practice games the same day. Boom, you're done. Mm-hmm. It's not this, as I always gave the elevator speech to parents about, you're not dragging your kid out there several nights a week to practice, after having gotten them home from school, done homework, dinner, and get them out to practice. Mm-hmm. And it's not all that craziness that is associated with so many youth sports programs. And it's affordable,
Exactly.
Yeah. Buy expensive
and
equipment.
And the practicing games on the same day was also born out of, for insurance purposes, only having it one day a week, and out of the convenience for the parents. It really had a dual positive impact on us.
Is
that it was going to be incredibly cost prohibitive to have practices 7 days a week or just open and having these games. But at the same time, parents were going, you mean tell me I could bring my kid day of the game, practice, and then play? And the best part of it is that kids, the way they learn, it's by practicing and then getting the opportunity to implement what they learned immediately after.
Yep.
Right. So a 5-year-old learns how to run a button hook on a Wednesday. Is not going to remember how to do that on a Saturday morning.
Right.
But the kids how to position themselves during that practice, and they go right into the game, you can see them develop. And of course, not only does it give the kid confidence because he or she is achieving and learning something, but now the parents are seeing a developmental difference in their child. They're seeing the kid having fun, he or she scores their first touchdown, or he or she's having fun with their friends and they're gaining more confidence. And that's the magic of I-9 sports, truly.
No, without a doubt. And, you know, as you know, I spent 22 years doing high-end computer software sales, and yeah, great money. But at the end of the day, it was so gratifying to see the kids and the parents going home happy at the end of the day. The kids had fun. Mm-hmm. They accomplished something. You know, maybe little Johnny caught a pass for the first time after having never caught one the previous 3 weeks, whatever it was. It was great. Mm-hmm. Very gratifying mm-hmm. to have that. And eventually, or to this day, I think I-9 Sports has got flag football, basketball, soccer, baseball, lacrosse, volleyball, cheerleading. Did I miss something there? Basketball? Did I say that? I don't know, but
yeah, you got them all.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So it's great. Now at this point, you know, in your book, which is called Running with My Head Down, you mentioned and I got to put on my glasses here real quickly here. You know, at this point in your career, you hopefully maybe came closer to the quest for purpose that you were looking for. Would you say?
Yeah, you know, so I thought when I started I-9 and it was growing, and I'm as, you know, I'm in the peak of I-9 sports. I'd say around 2011 was when I probably my peak of I-9, because I felt so alive and I felt like the company's running on all cylinders, and I felt like I found my purpose, so to speak, in life. Like, this makes total sense. Look, I'm this kid who had these wiffle ball leagues and these Stratomatic leagues and baseball cards and playing in leagues, and starts this adult men's softball league despite all the odds against me, and starts this I-9 program. And it's around this time that I'm thinking, I start having a little bit of internal conflict, because I'm thinking I found my purpose in life.
Right.
Until I have this epiphany that my identity of I-9 sports and myself are so intertwined. Mm. That when I'm having great days at I-9, I feel on top of the world. And when something goes wrong, my entire world is wrong.
Yep.
And I knew something had to change.
That was your Danger Will Robinson moment.
Yeah. So for those of you that know Tony, you know, know of Tony Robbins, he's this, you know, obviously incredible, inspirational person, but he's this great life coach who I've had the opportunity to, you know, to meet and to be, go to his events since the late 90s. And Tony's been a big inspiration to me. But I learned at one of his events called Date with Destiny, where I had this realization that, oh my gosh, my identity is so tied to I-9 that it's causing great pain. And then also, I also learned at this one particular event, Bill, that if I truly love the company as much as I say I do,
right,
then I give it what it needs. And when you give it what it needs, sometimes it means something more than just you. And too many people who are business owners, who I've met along the over the years, also have that identity crisis where they're so tied to their business that they also take the ship down because nobody can do it better than them. They don't hire for their weakness. They don't listen to other people. And that's how great companies go bad. And it dawned on me that if I really love I-9 sports, that I'm going to give it what it needs. And that's when I started making some, you know, critical hires. Well, back in 2008, I hired a president of our company who's the CEO and chairman of the company today, Brian. Thank goodness I did. That was me getting out of my way. That was me hiring for my weakness. And Brian is that manager leader. I might be the artist, so to speak, as we call it.
right.
But Brian is that manager leader. And together we became such a strong force. But it's so important that when you realize, am I having problems in what I'm doing? You know, think about, are you doing it for the right reasons, or are you doing it out of significance? Because there's really there's these six human needs, right? When our needs need to be fulfilled as humans, there's certainty, there's uncertainty and variety we want in our lives. We want to feel significant.
Okay.
We want love and connection. We want growth, and we want to contribute to the lives of others. Now, those first four human needs of certainty, uncertainty, significance, and loving connection, those are like the core four, so to speak, no pun intended. But those are your core human needs that we want to have met. And when we experience three or more of the overall six human needs. That's called a habit.
Ah.
And when we're not experiencing those human needs, when we're not feeling certain, if we're not getting that variety in our life, if we're not feeling significant, if we're not feeling connected to others, if we're not growing, and we don't feel like we're contributing, that's when you're depressed. That's when you're upset. Anytime you're not happy, think about, are any of those six human needs being met? Yes or no? I can tell you time and time again, you're going to come back and go, you know what? None of those needs are being met. And that's what was happening to me. I realized my needs were not being met any longer. I wasn't getting that sense. Although I wasn't feeling so certain about the business. You know, you have his ups and downs. I was getting variety. But as you know, in franchising, you don't always get the variety you want.
Right, that's true.
there was a level of significance, but Bill, the tough pill I had to swallow was that I wasn't needed anymore, and that was so tough for me.
Brutal, yeah, devastating.
I mean, my gosh, this was my baby, and now my baby didn't need me. But isn't that kind of weird? Because when we start something and we want to grow a business, the goal isn't the goal to hire people and have them doing all of the work for you.
Absolutely.
But guess what? When that happens, you come to the office and you go, there's nothing for me to do. I hired a great team around me. And then the job started getting lonely. And I started feeling lonely. I wasn't getting that connection as much.
Right.
And was I growing? Nope. Was I contributing? Nope. So now all of a sudden you can see why me as this person who had so much desire to create this thing and build it, I got to the point where it was sort of the top of the mountain. And I was like, now what?
Yeah. You had some other personal issues or setbacks, whatever, that took place along the way as well, right? Or was it all related to this?
Sure.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, what was physical, right?
Totally. So, yeah. You know, I was a kid. I struggled with my weight up and down from teenage years on up. You know, I was able to go up 20, 30 pounds at a clip. You know, and I got to the point when I was starting to run I-9 Sports, especially early on, where I was working such long days in the office. My butt was behind the desk on a chair, you know, at the computer, and I wasn't moving much, wasn't eating great.
Right.
And I think at one point I probably gained about 70 pounds, and I was so embarrassed because here I am, the CEO of a sports franchise.
Right.
And I'm like 70 pounds overweight. And I was like, something's got to change. I tried a few things, but quite honestly, I was so focused on the business at hand that I didn't really do the right thing to solve it. I actually, my wife and I stumbled on a friend. We saw a friend in a store who had previously been very heavy, and he was super, super fit. And I was like, Ralph, what happened to you? You lost all this weight. And he said to me, I found this doctor in South Tampa. It's amazing. He gives you these diet pills. He goes, they're appetite suppressants, and you get these vitamin B shots once a week. And he lost like 40 pounds like that. And I was like, no way. Give me his number. I called that doctor the next day.
Right.
Sure enough, I got my bottle of fendimetrazine. I got my B shot. And I was on my way, and I was losing 5, 6, 7, 8 pounds a week. And in no time, I went from 245 pounds to about 165 pounds.
Man, that's the magic pill every American wants, right?
Absolutely. And the best part about it, now, again, I don't know this. Now, just a little background. Never smoked a cigarette a day in my life. Never used recreational drugs. Yeah, I drank, you know, teenage years and stuff, and drank a little bit in my 20s.
Yeah.
But I had never purposefully done any kind of recreational drugs or all or anything. And this to me is safe because it's under a doctor's care, right? I'm going to a doctor.
Right.
Got the lab coat on, giving me the script, giving me, you know, checking my weight and everything. You're in good shape, Frank. Things are going great. Let me give you a script again for next week. I didn't read about this drug. I didn't know that it was basically a form of speed.
Sure.
And I also didn't know that you're only supposed to take it for about 4 to 6 weeks. And Bill, when I got to my goal weight, I couldn't stop taking the pill because I was taking it 3 times a day, just as prescribed. I never increased it because I was afraid I'd gain some weight. So maybe I would taper off, and I'd gain maybe a little bit. I would get back on it again. And
you felt good.
I felt incredible. Yeah. I had all this energy. Why? Because
it's speed.
Yeah. It's speed.
Right.
So I got to this point on and off. And you know what happened? As people probably know that are familiar with this drug or any kind of diet pill or any kind of speed, it starts to wear off and it doesn't work. And what I would do is after it stopped working, I would wait a while, 2, 3, 4 months. And then when I thought I was in the clear, I'd go back to the doctor and get back on it again, and it would start working again.
Right.
I was trying to give my body rest. Bill, I did this on and off. And I was honestly, I was absolutely sincere when I did this. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. But I look back now, and I did this on and off for 9 years.
Phew. Wow.
And this is a pill you're supposed to take 4 to 6 weeks. Again, tied to Tony Robbins, but I went to a Tony Robbins event and I had this epiphany. I had this realization that I am more than just what the scale says. I am more than just my weight. And I had a pill. I'll never forget, I was still taking it. And I had my pill in my front pocket of my jeans that I was supposed to take that night. And it was the night of the fire walk. People that are familiar with Tony Robbins, we do this fire walk.
Right.
And I took the pill and I threw it in the fire. And that was back in 2015. I have never touched fenobarbital ever in my life again, because it really changed my personality too. At times, obviously when you're on speed, you're going 100 miles a minute, but it also became detached at times to people. I realized,
and how so?
I never want you become attached. You don't become as emotionally. You're so focused on what you're doing that you're not as emotionally attached to people. I guess.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're so like focused on what you have to do. So I'd come home. I don't get me wrong. I would play with the kids. I'd spend time with my wife. But my head was so into I-9, what I needed to do. And after the kids would go to bed, I'd get back on the laptop.
Like, right.
You know, I was working away. You know, I would compare it to, for those of you that are familiar with the movie Limitless with Bradley Cooper. Remember that, where he takes the pill and he's a writer.
You know, the only kind of movie I see, like, have you seen Cece Sabathia's recent, you know, Under the Grapefruit Tree?
No, I heard of it, though.
Yeah, no, that's the kind of movie I watch.
Okay. You
know, it's about an hour long. I don't even know who Bradley Cooper is. I'm sorry.
Well, Bradley Cooper is an actor, and he had done this movie called Limitless, and it was a very well done movie. And he gets this drug, and he becomes like on fire of his ability to write and ability to calculate, and just he becomes this superhuman. And I saw that movie and I remember going, oh crap, that's me. That's not good. That needs to change.
Right.
That was it had an impact on me for sure.
Sure. Did it impact your relationship with your family?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was detached at times. My wife would say, you know, your personality is kind of altered when you're taking this. And I couldn't talk to my wife about it at times because she, you know, she wasn't for it. She was against it, but I didn't want to hear it because I wanted to try to stay thin. I didn't want to be this, you know, obese
right.
CEO of a sports franchise. And honestly, I was trying to do the right thing, but I went about it the wrong way. And I would tell anybody that making that difficult choice, of saying no more, I'm worth more than this. I'm more than just the scale. And more importantly, I was destroying my body long-term. And I would tell anybody that if they know deep down if they're doing the right thing or not, and that they need to listen to that little voice inside
right.
and to do the right thing.
Gotcha.
No matter how difficult it is, they can do it.
Yes. No, absolutely. So what do you do specifically, perhaps, to stay on the straight and narrow, if you would, not fall into that trap again?
Well, I think, you know, life is about zigzagging, right? So
right.
we have our little highs and lows. I think it's not being so strict. So, you know, today, yeah, I'll exercise. I do strength training, you know, 3 times, 4 times a week. I
Great.
Try to do a little bit of cardio. I'm not always good with doing the cardio. But I try to eat a little bit better. And I go up and down still, the highs and lows, but I'm not going up 70 pounds, losing 70 pounds. But more importantly, I think about myself. I see myself differently today than I saw myself back then. I know that who I really am and what's really important in life. And I think that we need to be a little more forgiving of ourselves. I think problem with us. Yeah. I think our biggest problem is that back with self-doubt. It's that little voice of criticism in ourselves that we think we need to be perfect. Look, we're not perfect. We're human beings, you know, and we're human beings that at times are human doings. And when we become a human doing, we're not being ourselves. And I would say that probably the best thing I did for myself was I forgave myself. I was very forgiving.
Huge.
And it's allowed me to have greater self-love. And the opportunity also allowed me to love other people much better, much deeper.
Right. And that's a whole separate discussion we could definitely have there. I mean, you hear there are a lot of books about it. There are a lot of podcasts about it. I mean, it's a very important topic that gets covered a lot, obviously. But it's great that you got to that point. It took some hard work to get there, though, right?
No question about it. It was challenged. But again, you get to look back and go, I did that. And because I had that challenge and overcame it, it builds that muscle, right?
Right.
That I can handle the next challenge because I get to use that as a point of reference.
Oh, yeah. No, I've kind of joked this past year that I wish more people on this planet were marathoners and ultramarathoners, because you go through those kind of struggles, you can get through COVID, you know? You know, not maybe the disease itself, but you can get through the whole, you know, pandemic and lockdowns and everything, you know, but I don't think enough people have that wherewithal to really just dig down and say, you know what, I can make it to that finish line. It's out there. You know, we know it's out there.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, God gives us adversity for a reason, I think. So it's how we look at it though. We get to choose whether we're going to use it for us or against us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you eventually sold off I-9 Sports and you have a new purpose now, correct?
Yeah. So I did sell I-9 when I realized that, okay, I think I've taken this as far as it should go for myself. And I started looking at myself as I could be the loving grandparent, right? The baby, right. I-9, grew up, got married, had kids of its own. And it's now time for me to enjoy it more of a distance. So I'm now a minority shareholder of the company.
Did Frankie or Taylor Marie have a kid? I missed this.
No.
Okay.
Right. You know, I get to love the business though, as the loving grandparent of the business. And I get the opportunity to, like a grandparent, give the kid back when I don't want to deal with any of the problems.
Right.
But I get to enjoy the company. And when I get to go to the board meetings and help the team strategically, they get to see it through the founder's eyes, just one voice. And I don't have all the answers, but I get to give them that point of reference of the past to hopefully be the bridge for the future of where they're taking the company. So that's the one thing I still do, although it doesn't take much of my time. But I really gave this a lot of thought on what I want to do with my life now. And it's been 3.5 years since I sold I-9. And it wasn't until recently that I decided that I need to live life much more meaningfully. I think I've been playing small ball for the past couple of years, despite, you know, writing the book, which was an honor. I'm so grateful to be able to do that. But I feel like I've been playing small lately for the last few years. And I thought, you know what, it's time for me, especially in light of the economic situation we're in today and probably in the foreseeable future, that I can take my experience to help entrepreneurs. So I created this new company called Game 3 Capital.
Okay.
Life's a game, hence game.
Right.
Three, as in this, the third company, right after ABA, I-9, and now this company. So it's called Game 3 Capital, and I'm helping out entrepreneurs. I'm investing in them, entrepreneurs that are successful with their business, that are looking to franchise their company. And I think that that's probably the best value I can provide to people now, is give them my expertise, my experience, to help them fulfill their dream in franchising. So I just launched a company a month ago. It's brand new, and I'm super excited about it. I've helped out a couple of companies I'm involved with currently. One is actually in sports and helping with this concussion app. Another company is in real estate, which I have a little bit of experience in the short-term rental market. But it's exciting to now do this business for other people now. It's not for myself.
Right.
This is all about helping other people grow their business.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Do they have to do a firewalk to be part of your organization?
You know what? That's a good idea.
Right.
we should do a Lego walk, exactly. Make it even more difficult, right? Put a bunch of Legos on the ground.
Ooh, man. You know, with the foot problems I'm having, that would be brutal. The firewalk would be easier.
True.
Congratulations. True. That's awesome. You got that
Thank
going.
You.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, I just launched it last month.
Nice. So when you write your next book, you know, I've started a new company also. It's called Summit Editing. I do book editing.
Okay.
And so I want to be the editor for your next book.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Oh, that's very cool.
Sounds good.
So, yeah, you know, I think one of the main reasons why people probably tune into this particular episode of this podcast is people are wondering why the hell the Yankees haven't signed DJ LeMahieu yet.
I think about that every day, actually.
Right.
Every day my son goes, they still didn't sign DJ. What are they doing?
I know. I mean, they need some of your business acumen, advice, whatever. I mean, they're playing with fire. That's what I was thinking about. They're playing with fire here. They're dicking around, not signing, arguably, the MVP of the team the last couple of years.
No, he is. He really is. And I think as fans, we also have to think about, okay, if this doesn't happen, what's plan B? You know, is plan B signing DD?
Right.
Putting him at shortstop where Glaber belongs, back at second. He's not a shortstop.
Yep.
And then taking that money and maybe signing a pitcher. You know, the whole thing with DJ is that obviously he was the best player on the team and we got him at a steal. But I was telling my son this the other day. I hate using this example because I love DJ LeMahieu and I hope they sign him. But, you know, remember when the Rangers had A-Rod and when they were trading him away, they said, look, we could be in last place with you or without you.
Right.
And not that DJ is any, you know, less of a player, and the Yankees were not in last place by any means. But just know, we didn't exactly win the World Series, or we didn't exactly lose in the ALCS because of DJ.
Right.
I want to see him there, but we are having issues. Obviously, by having DJ, we're forcing Glaber at shortstop, which is just so awkward. I love the guy. I think the kid is so talented, but he's clearly a second baseman. And then we got this weird situation at first base. You know, we guess it's Luke, and then at third base. What are we doing? Is it going to be Urshela? Is
oh yeah, definitely.
You know, I assume so. What are we doing with Miggy? Is Miggy going to be traded, or are we going to give him a shot again? You know, so
I don't know.
I think they need to make a decision. What are we going to do? I think a decision needs to be made, and we need to move on.
Yeah, they just don't have the pieces that fit together quite right. Is the problem? They're great pieces. They just don't quite fit in the right places where they should be, and.
Yeah. It's really, really odd. Obviously, we have problems, with catching, and we have some serious problems in the starting rotation. So as much as I want DJ, even if we sign him, we're not a lock
to
win this thing.
No, we got more to do. Absolutely.
No, and we still got Chapman closing out a game 7, too, that we need to get past that one as well.
Oh, my God. That's got to bother me as much as any Scum Sox fan hates hearing the word Bucky Dent.
Right. Yeah. No, I like Chapman a lot, but man, I just am so uncomfortable every time he comes into a big spot, because I know it's going to be.
He's going to throw a damn slider. He's going to throw a damn slider. Right. But you should throw in the heater, right?
Right. It's always an adventure. It's never, three up and three down. It always has to be a freaking adventure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh God. Frank, who's your least favorite Red Sox?
Right now, I honestly feel bad for him. Benintendi really gets under my skin.
Yeah. Historically.
It's that smirk on his face really gets under my skin.
especially since they're losers. You know, it's one thing if you're smirking and you're winning.
I kind of feel bad for them now. I mean, you know. But yeah, I'd say probably Benintendi probably gets under my skin the most now. It's just he's got that smirk on his face. And he's a Yankee killer too. Don't get me wrong. Now, not liking him and respecting is two different things. I mean, the guy's a freaking Yankee killer.
Right.
And I still respect him. He can still hit a whole lot better than I could. So he's still a good ball player. But as a Yankee diehard fan, yeah, Benintendi gets under my skin because he kills us so often.
Yep. I hear you. I just, you know, the Yankees Red Sox rivalry has definitely gotten diluted lately. It's not as, you know, it's back to like back in the 70s, early 70s. Well, I'm trying to think of 80s when you just felt sorry for Red Sox fans. You didn't really hate them. You just had pity for them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of getting that way a little bit now. You know, they're a few years removed from winning a World Series. That's gone more towards pity, kind of like, you know, the Cubs are kind of fading away again. And but
true.
Yeah, there's just David Ortiz. I just hate that SOB so bad.
I like David Ortiz. I just think, although he, again, another guy that killed us, but, you know, he's a guy for me was so hard to root against because you can tell how big of a heart he has, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And he's one of those guys you never want to face. But it's almost like, you know, the Red Sox fans would talk about Derek Jeter. They didn't hate Derek. Like, they totally respected him, admired Derek Jeter. You just didn't want to face him in a big spot.
Sure. You
know? And I kind of felt the same way about Big Poppy because he was another great player.
Clutch player. Absolutely clutch. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely clutch. And those are the players that I've always admired the most.
Right.
Are the clutch players, the Scott Brosius of the world that come through when it freaking counts. I don't care you bat it too far right. during the season. To be absolutely money yep. in October, to me, is the only thing that counts.
Right.
So, you know, that's that goes a long way in my book.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then, of course, there's the cheating fucking Astros, but.
Yes.
We won't go there. Fuck them.
No, exactly. I agree with you. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. So, hey, Frank, just kind of getting back to the point here, you know, achieving purpose, what kind of final words would you tell people along those lines?
I would say that if you're don't search for your purpose, what I would say is that your purpose will find you, that you need to do what you love. And when you do what you love, it's funny how things show up. Your purpose ultimately is about being fulfilled. And when you're no longer fulfilled with what you're doing, guess what? It's time to move on and do something else. That's nature calling you and saying, it's time to close the chapter and start a new one. No matter how much you love what you were doing, you know when it's time to pack your bags and move on to the next chapter. And you can do it.
Makes absolute sense. And it can change many times in an adult lifetime, right? I mean, there are some studies that show that the average adult changes careers 7 times in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it's because you're following a passion. You know, you're finding, you know, it's just like you have a college sweetheart or something and, you know, you think mm-hmm. you're in love forever. And then all of a sudden you find yourself drifting in 2 different directions and the relationship breaks up. And same thing, you may fall in love with a job. You may think this is your purpose in life, but as you get older, mm-hmm. you kind of find, you know what? I'm kind of thinking more about, you know, I want to do philanthropy or, you know, I want to, you know, help the,
right.
you know, work in a soup kitchen or whatever it is. You find something mm-hmm. that's more fulfilling.
Yep. You can't be afraid to move on. You know, I mentioned the book so many times about live your life with no regrets. You don't want to ever look back and go, I would have, could have, should have.
No, without a doubt. So true. Mm-hmm. The book, by the way, is Running With My Head Down, An Entrepreneur's Story of Passion, Perseverance, and Purpose by Frank Fiume. And people can find this just about anywhere, correct?
Yep. Amazon, easiest way to find it.
Gotcha. That's cool. And where can people find you, Frank?
You can go to my website, frankfiume.com. That's FIUME.com. You can also find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, pretty much anywhere.
Great. So, you know, hopefully people can get a hold of you. They can find out about, what's the name of the new business again?
Game 3 Capital.
You know, if you have a business you'd love to franchise, he's your man. He has got the experience of taking a very modest softball league on Long Island and turning it into a youth sports juggernaut that stretches from coast to coast, well, and beyond, out to Hawaii, where, you know, old Roger out there created a kingdom.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, hey, Frank, cool. This has been a pleasure having you here. I mean, it's
great
to catch up. I think we last saw each other maybe 2019, but it's always great to mm-hmm. catch up. And you're such an inspiration. Like I say, you got me to I-9 Sports when things were just getting off the ground, and you were such a motivating force for all my years there. And it's great to see how, you know, that has flourished, even though mm-hmm. daddy's walked away from it. And yep. And, you know, just seeing that you're moving on to bigger and better things. And it's just great.
Means a lot to me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, again, Frank, thank you so much. Keep doing great stuff. Keep, you know, we're how many days away from pitchers and catchers reporting and hopefully.
Ooh, got to be close. Yeah. Yeah. Probably about 40 days. That's maybe 30 days away, actually.
Yep. getting there. So, yeah, can't wait to see. Hopefully have a baseball season, but hopefully get the Yanks back where they belong on top.
Yes, sir.
And then we can hear once again, Yankees win. Yankees win. All right. Well, Frank, thank you so much. Great to talk with you again. And best of luck here in the new year. Stay healthy.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
You bet. Wow. Frank has a really powerful message there, doesn't he? That if you have a vision and make it your mission, you can succeed with it. So I really appreciate him joining us on the podcast for that. Definitely look into picking up his book, Running With My Head Down, An Entrepreneur's Story of Passion, Perseverance, and Purpose. And of course, right after we recorded this episode, the Yankees did sign DJ LeMahieu to a long-term contract. So everything is good in the world again. So thank you again for listening to the We Are Superman podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. These 5-star ratings help us rise higher in the podcast services search algorithms, helping more people find the show. Until next time, always be positive.